Stay tuned for Nightline Africa, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
An escalation of violence in Syria's largest city. A warning to those considering more protests in Turkey. I'm Ira Melman reporting from Washington. Syrian activists say rebels have blown up a tunnel they filled with explosives in the northern city of Aleppo. That's Syria's largest. It killed at least 20 pro-government fighters. The British-based Syrian Observatory for Human Rights says the blast took place near the Zahrawi Market in Old Aleppo. Syria's largest rebel alliance, the Islamic Front, claimed responsibility for the attack. In a tweet, the group claimed it killed 40 government forces with the explosion. The group also posted a video of the attack on Twitter. It shows a huge explosion throwing a massive cloud of debris into the air. Rebels have recently been using tunnels to plant explosives beneath army positions. Now in its fourth year, the Syrian conflict has killed more than 160,000 people. Military officials in Pakistan say a soldier and 16 Taliban militants have been killed in an ambush on a border post in the rest of northwestern tribal area. The military says between 150 and 200 insurgents crossed the border from Afghanistan early Saturday morning and attacked a group of Pakistani military checkpoints. The attack took place in the Bajor tribal region, triggering a gun battle that lasted for hours, with helicopter gunships being sent in for backup. A spokesman said two soldiers had been wounded and the death toll could rise. The governor of neighboring Afghanistan's Kunar province said the Pakistani helicopters crossed into Afghanistan territory and four civilians were killed in the shooting. Pakistan did not comment on whether its forces had indeed crossed the border. Pakistan and Afghanistan share a volatile and porous border, and militants from both nations cross it to use the neighboring country as a safe haven. Turkey's prime minister has issued a call for people to ignore calls for protests to mark the first anniversary of anti-government demonstrations. Last year's unrest posed one of the biggest threats to the more than decade-long rule of the Turkish prime minister. Dorian Jones has more from Istanbul.
25,000 police backed by 50 water cannon trucks and helicopters have been deployed in Istanbul to prevent any repeat of last year's anti-government demonstrations. There have been calls for nationwide protests by civic groups and trade unions to mark the first anniversary of the unrest. Prime Minister Recep Tayyip Erdogan, in a Friday address, slammed the demonstrators and warned the young not to get involved. The brutal eviction by police of a handful of environmentalists protecting Istanbul's Gezi Park from government plans to turn it into a shopping mall sparked last year's civic unrest. The protests quickly evolved into broader discontent against the government and in particular the Prime Minister, spreading to nearly every city in Turkey. Dorian Jones for VOA News, Istanbul, Turkey.
The U.S. Defense Secretary has accused China of destabilizing actions in the South China Sea. Chuck Hagel told defense officials at the annual Shangri-La Dialogue in Singapore Saturday that Washington would not look the other way if international order is threatened. He accused China of restricting the Philippines' access to Scarborough Shoal, beginning land reclamation at various locations in the South China Sea, and erecting an oil rig in disputed waters with Vietnam.
China has called the South China Sea a sea of peace, friendship, and cooperation. And that's what it should be. But in recent months, China has undertaken destabilizing unilateral actions asserting its claims in the South China Sea.
The U.S. defense chief said that while Washington does not take sides on rival claims, the U.S. opposes any nation's use of intimidation, coercion, or threat of force to assert those claims. Find out more about this story on our website at voanews.com. At the same Singapore conference Saturday, Secretary Hagel demanded that coup leaders in Thailand release detainees and immediately hold general elections after Thai military leader General Prayuth Chan-o-cha said a return to civilian rule is probably at least a year away. Hagel also called on the junta to end its curbs on free expression, including banning political gatherings of more than five people and tight media controls. I'm Ira Melman, VOA News, reporting from Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening. This is Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of the Voice of America. I'm Douglas Mpuga.
And I'm Odette Fraser. Thanks for joining us.
According to WHO, a global 50% increase in taxes on cigarettes would lead to 49 million fewer smokers and save 11 million lives.
Governments urged to raise taxes on tobacco in order to curb smoking.
Zimbabweans have a right to know the state of health of their leader. More importantly, Mugabe, because he's in government.
Zimbabwean political leaders are fend off rumors about the state of their health.
I think we focus a lot on the problem of demand being focused in Asia, but in fact, the United States is a major consumer of wildlife products, so we have some work to do here as well.
And the illegal killing of an elephant in Africa becomes a national security issue in other countries. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa.
Malawi has a new president. Peter Mutharika was sworn in Saturday in the commercial capital Blantyre. The 74-year-old leader of the Democratic Progressive Party said in a brief address that his main task would be uniting Malawians after the protracted wrangling over electoral issues. He invited his competitors to help him rebuild the country. On Friday, election officials declared Mr. Mutharika the winner of last week's disputed presidential election after defeating incumbent President Joyce Banda. Mr. Mutharika, the brother of late President Bingwa Mutharika, will have an inauguration ceremony Sunday.
To mark World No Tobacco Day, the World Health Organization is calling on governments to raise taxes on tobacco. WHO says this is the most effective way to reduce smoking and prevent the premature death of millions of people. Lisa Schwan reports for VOA from WHO headquarters in Geneva.
Tobacco use is the world's leading preventable cause of death. The World Health Organization reports tobacco kills nearly 8 million people a year. This includes more than 600,000 non-smokers who are dying from breathing in other people's smoke. WHO warns tobacco will cause the deaths of about 1 billion people by the end of this century if no action is taken. It says 80% of these deaths will occur in low and middle-income countries. The UN Health Agency says most of these premature deaths can be prevented through measures that discourage people from taking up smoking and encourage them to stop. It says the most effective way of doing this is by imposing high taxes on a pack of cigarettes and other tobacco products. Coordinator of WHO's Tobacco Control Economics Unit, Ida Ureke, says evidence shows that raising taxes not only saves lives, but generates significant revenue for governments.
So these are the win-win policies for public health and the economy. According to WHO, a global 50% increase in taxes on cigarettes would lead to 49 million fewer smokers and save 11 million lives. One of WHO's highest priorities in tobacco control is to prevent young people from starting to use tobacco. And such tax increases can prevent 11 million young people from becoming smokers.
Ureke says this is especially important for developing countries with large and growing young populations. She notes poor countries are especially in need of healthy young people to boost their development. They also can use the money generated from tobacco taxes to improve their economies. The World Health Organization calculates governments around the world would earn an extra $101 billion in revenue if all countries increased tobacco taxes by 50% per pack. An example of how this works can be seen in South Africa. That country increased taxes on cigarettes from 32% to 52% between 1993 and 2009. During this period, WHO notes cigarette sales went down 30% and government revenue went up from nearly $1 billion to more than $8 billion. While tax hikes may be good for the public and governments, it is bad news for the tobacco industry. Program manager for the prevention of non-communicable diseases at WHO, Armando Poruga, tells VOA, the industry is worried that increased taxes will result in lost sales.
In order to avoid that, they use different tactics, such as, for example, try to press on the government the false idea that the tobacco industry will have to leave the country with the loss of revenue for the country, and they will say that they will lose employment, and also they will use some tactics that are not so legal in trying to convince parliamentarians to vote against the increase of taxes.
The World Health Organization cites tax increases as the most effective among a number of tobacco control measures. Other measures include the establishment of smoke-free environments, health warnings on cigarette packages, and a ban on all forms of advertising, promotion, and sponsorship of tobacco products. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Still on tobacco, the World Lung Foundation works with, among others, governments in Africa. The foundation advises those governments on how to do mass education campaigns on the dangers of smoking. Rebecca Powell is the director of social projects at the World Lung Foundation. I reached her in New York and began by asking her how she thought how widespread smoking is in Africa.
Africa is the only country left in the world, really, where smoking rates are still extremely low. Most countries, the rates are still in the single digits, unlike in the Americas or Europe or Asia. So there's still a chance to stem the epidemic before the industry has its claws completely wrapped around the country.
Yeah, and despite these low rates of smoking on the continent, there are still quite big consequences for smoking.
Yes, yes. The thing about smoking is that it will bring an epidemic of heart disease and cancer, lung diseases, and even diabetes. And this is something that no country can really afford to have. What you really don't want to see happen is replace infectious diseases with non-infectious diseases in Africa. That would be a tragedy.
Do you think, in your opinion, the governments in Africa are doing enough?
No, I think some of them are trying, and I think we're seeing some movement. I think they recognize that prevention is important, but I think they can do more, and I think it's important that they feel the urgency of moving quickly, because the tobacco industry will move quickly too.
And some analysts have observed that there's a conflict in some governments in Africa where they are torn between generating revenue out of tobacco sales vis-a-vis the health concerns. Have you looked at that point?
And I think that's very real. I think that they are interested in the quick money that the tobacco industry offers, but in the long run, that's a deal with the devil. Because in the long run, what they're going to get is, as I said, epidemics of heart disease and cancer, a sick population that will not be able to work, will not help the economy. If the government was to put in strong tobacco control laws, like smoke-free laws and taxes, and run mass education campaigns, these things work like a vaccine against non-communicable diseases like heart disease and cancers.
And given the fragility of some of the governments in Africa, do you see them standing up to big tobacco?
I think they can and they should and they must. I think there's really no other choice. I think all big tobacco brings is misery in the long run.
Now, what do you see as the way forward now? What should be done?
Right. Well, there's something called the FCTC, Framework Convention on Tobacco Control, which is a treaty. There's going to be a meeting in the fall in Moscow. And I think these governments must come to this meeting and must be serious about moving forward with pack warnings, with high taxes that will keep people from buying cigarettes, with smoke-free laws, with bans against advertising, and with education campaigns. If they do these things, we know, and we've seen in other countries, that if they do these things work in concert to reduce smoking prevalence, and this is what we're looking for. And these are all part of the FCTC. They're part of this treaty, and they need to follow what's in this treaty. And we are seeing some success stories. We are seeing some countries moving. Senegal, most notably, just moved forward with comprehensive tobacco control legislation. This is a really great thing, and other countries need to follow suit.
That was Rebecca Powell, the Director of Special Projects at the World Lung Foundation. She spoke with me from New York.
Sierra Leone's Chief Medical Officer, Dr. Brian Makagbo, says the country is in a state of national emergency following confirmed cases of the deadly Ebola virus. In a phone interview from Freetown, Dr. Brian Makagbo told me that health officials are working on containing the spread of the virus.
We actually reactivated the rapid response teams at district level, and we have engaged the paramedics, the local leaders, and community members for them to understand the risk of Ebola. Because what we have realized was that the index case was somebody who visited Guinea and participated in a funeral of somebody who died of Ebola in neighboring Guinea. And that person was a traditional healer whom people frequently visited, and all those affected so far are women within the community. So what the government has done is actually engaged the members of parliament, the paramount chiefs, the local community leaders to ensure that they pass on the messages very accurately for people to know the risk as to how they can prevent themselves from contracting the virus.
So what is the government actually doing to contain the disease?
Well, what the government has done is to actually intensify the contact tracing of those who came into contact of the infected individuals. The government has also established isolation units within the health facilities in the border areas, even including the western area and some of the regional hospitals. Also provided personal protective equipment for almost all health workers for them to get a barrier against the infected patients that they are taking care of. So the government has actually done a lot to ensure that we intensify awareness raising and provide the necessary materials to ensure that people have the adequate knowledge and skills to really take care of those who are infected with the virus.
Do you have any confirmed cases in the capital, Freetown?
No. There was a rumor of 3 suspected cases, one at the emergency hospital. It turned out to be negative, and also 2 rumors of suspected cases from the hospital. They took the sample to Kenema. They turned out to be negative. So far, we have not had any positive confirmed case in the capital.
What advice would you give to the people of Sierra Leone regarding the transmission and spread of the disease?
What we actually advise people is so they restrict their movement to affected areas, and also not to come into close contact with individuals who are infected with the virus, and also people not to wash corpses that they may have died of suspected Ebola, and also to stop eating bush meat, because that is the first mode of transmission from the body fluids of these wild animals in the bush. So this is the advice that we actually provide to our compatriots in Sierra Leone.
You're advising people not to come in contact with people who already have the disease. How will they know?
Immediately, they suspect some high fever with diarrhea and vomiting and bleeding. They should immediately alert the health worker in the nearest health center so that they will not come into contact with them. Because the only way that you know that person has Ebola is through diagnosing the virus in the laboratory.
Sierra Leone's Chief Medical Officer, Dr. Brian Makagbo, I reached him in Freetown.
In Zimbabwe, President Robert Mugabe and his political rival, former Prime Minister Morgan Tsvangirai, are facing a dilemma of fending off rumors about the state of their health. But as Studio 7's Ndimiyake Mwakalieli reports, analysts say the key to quelling the speculation lies with them.
The recent video that went viral showing President Robert Mugabe arriving at a clinic in Singapore and the explosion of comments on Facebook and other social media platforms following up on reports that MDC founding leader Morgan Tsvangirai was gravely ill is evidence of the public's interest in their health, say analysts. South African-based social commentator Mlamuli Nkomo says this is expected.
To a certain level, Zimbabweans have a right to know the state of health of their leader. More importantly, Mugabe, because he's in government,
President Mugabe has long been dogged by rumors of ill health, sparked in 2008 by a leaked diplomatic cable quoting former Reserve Bank Governor Gideon Gono saying the president had prostate cancer. Despite assurances by Mr. Mugabe that he is in good health and that his frequent visits to Asia are for a routine eye checkup, the public remains unconvinced. His recent absence from the state burial of Brigadier General John Zingoni, as well as the cancellation of a Politburo meeting due to his absence, had refueled the speculation. Political analyst Paul Chimosha, based in South Africa, says it's too late to quell the rumors.
ZANU-PF and Robert Mugabe, they have lost credibility long time ago as far as communicating the health status of their leadership. It's a very simple issue. People are human beings. They're all 10, 90 years old at some point. And it's only natural that they'll fall sick. And just being honest for a change, just to say there is a problem. We cannot get the treatment we require at Bari or at trauma center. The specialist is located in Singapore, and this is the diagnosis, and the president will be home. That's all.
Speculation about Changirai's health surfaced when he recently failed to attend two major rallies in Harare. Speaking with reporters at his residence Thursday, Changirai acknowledged he was not well, but dismissed reports in the state-run Herald newspaper that it was serious and that he had been hospitalized. Chimosha warns Changirai, whose officials have been giving mixed and contradictory information on his health, could face the same fate.
For the MBC, it was actually a grand opportunity for them to start building credibility along those lines. In a way where they would have said, this is the problem with the president. This is the patient management plan that has been proposed by his doctors. This is what we are following. This is the problem, and this is where he is. Full stop.
Analyst George Mkwananzi agrees, citing South Africa's handling of the news of former President Nelson Mandela's failing health.
If both leaders reveal the real nature of their ailments, then the speculation will stop. They are public figures. I don't think even the issue of privacy is so much important. In the case of Nelson Mandela, the public in South Africa and the world at large was informed at every stage of what was happening to Mandela in terms of his state of health, exactly what was the problem with him. Nobody speculated about him.
To the contrary, says Dr. Rutendo Bonde, chair of the Zimbabwe Association for Doctors for Human Rights, health matters are personal, even for public figures.
A lot has to do with educating the public that privacy is universal. It doesn't matter whether you're a public figure or not. It's privileged information. And unless either of the two politicians come out and speak about their health, then it is better conduct for the media to refrain from that kind of journalism.
Commentator Mlamuli Nkomo says lack of information tends to fuel media speculation.
When things are covered up, people come out with a speculation, and I'm sure people can understand why the private media can speculate on Mugabe's health, because nothing is coming out from the government officials. In terms of some of the stories that are coming from the Herald about Tsvangirai escaping from the hospital without paying, I think it's irresponsible for especially, particularly the Herald.
While the well-being of Mr. Mugabe and Mr. Changirai are important to many, the real concern, say analysts, is the fate of the nation in the event a leader's illness leads to his incapacitation. Mkwananzi explains.
Will the country be plunged into a situation of chaos and lawlessness if Robert Mugabe will not be there? He has been holding together all the different pieces that make up ZANU-PF. So that concern about his state of health is coming from that kind of worry.
For analyst Paul Chimosha, herein lies the problem.
Do you craft a nation around individuals to say, if Robert Mugabe dies today, there will be pandemonium in Zimbabwe? If Tsvangirai dies today, the MDC is gone. That is exactly the problem. We craft our nation around people rather than institutions. Yes, we need somebody to take ultimate responsibility to ensure that those institutions run as intended by the nation. But the nation itself should be run by credible democratic institutions. And the removal of an individual, yes, should have an impact if that guy was actually worth his salt. But if institutions are strong, it shouldn't be a cause of panic. the next guy must move in and replace the other one peacefully without any problems.
Reporting for Studio 7, this is Ndimiake Mwakalielie in Washington.
Thanks, Ndimi. The illegal killing of an elephant in a national park in Kenya is now a national security issue in Washington, D.C. and many more countries. A new tougher approach to poaching comes as the trafficking of elephant tusks and rhino horns reaches nearly $20 billion in annual sales. VOA's William Eagle reports on the war against the ivory trade.
China embarked this year on a major campaign to persuade ivory lovers to get out of the habit of buying ivory carvings. That was big news several months ago when television cameras showed bulldozers in Guangzhou crushing tons of elephant tusks confiscated from smugglers. China's campaign continues with the broadcast of a public service announcement against poaching with former National Basketball Association player Yao Ming. The announcement shows the towering 7.5-foot-tall athlete looking down with sadness at a butchered elephant carcass on a Kenyan savanna. Brooke Darby says there should be more campaigns like China's in many countries. Darby is Deputy Assistant Secretary of State for International Narcotics and Law Enforcement, the U.S. agency that has taken on the poaching issue as a part of a global crime wave.
I think we focus a lot on the problem of demand being focused in Asia, but in fact, the United States is a major consumer of wildlife products, so we have some work to do here as well. We're right up there. One of the things that we've learned is that often consumers don't realize that the animal dies when the tusks or the horn are taken, and therefore these trinkets that they've picked up that are made of ivory actually result, a function of an animal dying in the field.
John Calvelli of the Wildlife Conservation Society says the United States is one of the largest users of ivory in the world. Probably, he says, one of the top five.
I will tell you, take a walk on the streets of New York and you will find ivory for sale. And you realize studies have been done that show that probably about one-third of the ivory in the United States comes from illegally killed elephants.
John Webb is a former prosecutor of wildlife crimes for the U.S. Justice Department and a member of the President's Advisory Committee on Wildlife Crime. He confirms the United States is a huge market for ivory fueled by internet sales. For years, U.S. laws prohibited the sale of ivory taken from elephants killed after the CITES Treaty was signed in 1973. But it was difficult to tell the age of the ivory in a store window. Calvelli says there are efforts to pass a moratorium on all ivory sales in New York State. Greater impact may come from President Obama's announcement of a ban on all ivory sales within the United States. The new regulation, which prohibits the trade of any item that contains ivory of any age, is being criticized by antique dealers. If strictly enforced, it could end the sale of certain chess pieces, the handles of revolvers, letter openers, piano keys, and the bows of some violins. Since President Obama issued an executive order creating a 17-agency task force to combat wildlife trafficking, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service has prosecuted several cases of black market trade in rhino horns. A Canadian art import and export firm doing business in Cameroon and the United States was fined $100,000 for shipping parts of 21 elephants to Ohio. The United States government has become a leader in international efforts to end poaching and the international shipment and sales of illegal ivory. The U.S. Agency for International Development has funded regional alliances of conservation and law enforcement agencies, such as Asia's Regional Response to Endangered Species Trafficking, or ARREST, in Bangkok, where there have been some successful busts. Webb has watched the growth of these regional networks with great interest.
Cops don't trust each other. I mean, that's the bottom line. And so one of the reasons why you create these wildlife enforcement networks is it's much easier to work with somebody who you've met face-to-face and know than it is some faceless law enforcement official from a foreign country.
More attention is being paid to judicial systems in African countries where wildlife crimes may not be punished. But Webb says government officials and the courts of many African countries represent the biggest challenge to the termination of the poaching of wildlife. However, the challenge of saving Africa's elephants is likely more complex than anyone yet realizes. Varun Vira is an analyst at C4 Ads and the co-author of Ivory's Curse, The Militarization and Professionalization of Poaching. Vira cites the work of the World Bank and others who draw a correlation between poaching and the long-term impacts of poverty, hunger, and infant mortality. Some of these observers note that poaching has been going on in Africa for centuries. I'm William Eagle in Washington.
This is the Voice of America, and you're listening to Nightline Africa.
And still to come in the program, we shall have the Saturday Music Spot from our collection of music from across the continent. And that will be followed by a commentary by Dr. Suleiman Nyang, Professor of African Studies and Comparative Politics at Howard University.
It's now time for our Saturday Music Spot, so sit back, relax, and enjoy.
Mango, 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 mango Sita mangi solo male sinyo yuma kanyi koneti badinya majamfa badinya atunya nurobi anyi silam badinya niye ima yeladi akabu nodi yako koni beni nodi nyale badingaro sidi akabu nodi yako Koni beni no di yale, badinyaro, badinyato no kabo, badinyakadi, tasilam badinyanina, yela. Setana mano milo kudukela, ibade mala, setana bolila yarabila.
Badinyane, jinya badinyane fisa, badinyane.
Mo bade mande yamadunila.
Mario, Luca ta mwasi yo moko bala. Mario mosalo be kulinga ba mama mobokoli. Basuka yote, ah.
Lelo makambo lobi makambo na lembi eh. Lelo bitumba lobi kosona e na baye eh. Na boyi ko baby sanzoto na manzanga na lembi eh. Mario.
Kulinga kapesi bazei na mbongo Yoka ndengi azariko kabayo Na mitema ya basi pe na mibali Yumo tozei na badiplom mitano Mario Sala kameme foro luka mosala Mario Pona nino za po baby saka usambu sa kombo nobo Mario Ah, nalembi
Ba protinga na pakolaka Zoto eko ma sembe sembe Oko pete ngana zoka Lobi na shwa maladi ya kanser Lobi tango na kopola yo kimi kaye Mario na baye Mario na lembie
Ba familia Mario bakanisaka Mario apesaka nga mosoro Nzoka nga moto na latisaka ye na leisaka ye na lalisaka ye Mario na lembie
Paizua ya biloko e
Nakuta kinga na yango
e Ikambo moke mosala kobo mabi
Biloko ya ndako e
Na somba Na lebie e Mario na baye yo Kende Mario na lebio
Mario Okutinga na biloko mombali mosusu a somba Oyoke lingia kofanga te Mario Oyoko ilingite olia na mesa Kaka soki zue kangyo na poitrine Oniaga kopeta ngai nako boma biloko Mario, sinasali sayo mingi Diploma si mangamu na seisa kiyo Mario Bongo leonga kumimwa si mabe Mario likambote Ah, mokilie, ezaka kapoye
Mobali akutinga na bomengo asengi ya komandenga na nimi Mobali akutinga na bangenge asengi ya dirijenga na nimi Na bandiko bimana ye,
babandiko penga ye, monsieur
Mario abimbi moto, akanisi biloko na ngaya ye Mario na baye yo Kende Mario na lembi yo
Mario asongi epe ya babotia
komi tango akolala mbeto mokuse makolo milai mario mario nalembi somba mbeto na baye mario nalembi
koyoka motema pasi te nakonga moko nafutaka ilama nasombela yo natikeli yo souvenir ya bolingo oyo ezali na lavage nakotindela yo na bato mario nalembi yo kende na yo na baye yo
la fusée Mario Mario Mosala Kopete Nga Bana Di Koko Banango Ya Yo Olingo Beba Mama Mobokoli
Paizua ya lokuta, e paizua ya biloko, akuta kinga na yango, ikambo moke mosala koboma biloko ya nako era somba, na paye yo, Mario na lembi yo, bima bima na paye yo,
Mario na lembo ngwali kelemba, mitutu kumisatu. Na sombi Mercedes 190 na ibisi Mario mokomosi tobima toke na osa promenade tokomi na nzela Mario binanga yo zonga kotenga na zali na kumba fratur po bamona kengangu na sombeli yango na ibisi Mario te ngapina na poso na kumba po eloko na sombi sika bato sobango na pengangu na sombi toweli volanga na Mario Mario atutelinga vatu na nzete
nzoto ezali nano ya meme olingi yo bebisanga elongi Signor Sosua Camosala, come mi savango di lunghi, che pananga nesto pe na lembio. Mario papa na paye yo, che nena yo na lembio.
Sua matama na pomade oh ateza mwindo ya motane alinga kobala basi ya age na yete alinga obeba mama mobokoli Mario
Mario by Franco and earlier on you had Alako Walaho by Sekuba Fatako of Guinea, and that was followed by Bena Bona by Kafala Kante, also of Guinea. And I sincerely hope you enjoyed that music from across the continent. And now the Saturday commentary by Dr. Suleiman Yang, Professor of African Studies and Comparative Politics at Howard University here in Washington. Take it away, Dr. Yang.
Hello. Every passing week, I pay close attention to America's relations with Africa. And the Voice of America has been a very powerful source for me to share my reflections on America's policies towards Africa. And I'm also interested in African opinions on and attitudes toward the United States. It is because of this convergence of interests that I take every week as a very important opportunity to make issues broadcasted through the Voice of America to Africa. It is sad today for us to learn about the departure of an iconic figure who played a very important role in American-African relations. I'm talking about Maya Angelou, who was born in 1928 and passed away this year, 2014. She's widely celebrated in terms of America's relations with Africa. And I'm going to take the next 5 minutes to underscore some of the things she did for American-African relations. She is now quoted in the media as saying, "I have land," and I'm putting a quotation mark, "I have land that people will forget what you said. People will forget what you did, but people will never forget how you made them feel." It is a very powerful statement from her. As in the days of the great thinkers from the past, we're in the West, and we are very much influenced by thinkers from the Greek, Roman, and Hebrew narratives. Maya Angelou is a great representative of America for African understanding of America. Maya Angelou's life took her to Ghana when Kwame Nkrumah was the president of Ghana. If you look at African Americans who operated out of the United States in Africa, there were a large number of them who were African American immigrants living in Ghana during the Kwame Nkrumah period. Let me underscore a number of points for our references. We have Richard Wright, who is a celebrated African American writer, who wrote about the coming to power of Kwame Nkrumah. And he was there together with many others. So you have some of the Caribbean, like George Padmore, who was very close to Kwame Nkrumah, who and C.L.R. James. James was a contemporary. When I was at Howard as a young man, he came and was brought by Chiki Anuachi on our program to have Leon Damas and Elliot Skinner, all from the Caribbean, who were part of African Studies at Howard. So when we talk about Maya Angelou, we talk about Maya Angelou, Martin Luther King, Malcolm X, and a whole number of African Americans who were in Ghana during the Kwame Nkrumah period. When President Obama went to Ghana, he was traveling on that path, which was laid by many, and Maya Angelou was one. And Maya Angelou's influence was not only evident among those narratives, but it was also evident when Maya Angelou was very much honored by Bill Clinton as President of the United States, when Clinton gave him that very prominent role of reading her poetry to the nation. And that's part of Maya Angelou's legacy. Going back to the struggle in the civil rights movement, coming from the South, and having great influence on a number of other people. And one of her achievements is our sister and very active, Oprah Winfrey, who was very close to her. And so when we talk about Maya Angelou, one could write many books, not only about her words, which will be remembered, but also her own deeds among us. Because Maya Angelou's story is just one dot, like all of us. And when we connect her dots with many of the other dots, you will be surprised how many dots are part of this long line of meaning, linking her to the civil rights movement, to the African struggle, to the independence of South Africa, and her own writings, which are still available. And I'm sure many will be buying reprints of her books over and over again. And here she is very much in the tradition of old Africa, where we have storytellers like Kochi Barma from West Africa, from our area in Gambia. There are many Kochi Barmas elsewhere in Ghana. You know, many Ghanaians are influenced, many Sierra Leoneans, many Igbos, many Yorubas, many Kikuyus, many Luos. And you can go around Africa and you see the historical anthropology of Africa, and you can see the likes of Maya Angelou. Because we are in the West today, we are very much influenced by the parables, the narratives of Jesus of Nazareth, who was very influential among the Hebrew people. And you go back to Abraham and Moses for the Hebrew people. But when you look at Maya Angelou as an African American, she is very much part of all that. And these are all the legacies of America. And that's one of the reasons why when we talk about African relations with the United States or United States relations with Africa, Maya Angelou is an icon which will be remembered by many of us. And may God bless us all.
That commentary by Dr. Suleiman Nyang. We'll be right back.
Nightline Africa comes to you on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC from the English service of The Voice of America.
Thanks for joining us tonight. I'm Douglas Mpuga.
And I'm Odette Frazier. Have a good evening.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
In many developing nations, the extraction of minerals is crucial to the local economy. If used for the common good, these resources can lift countries out of poverty by providing jobs and accelerating economic growth to provide quality education, health care, and other needed government services. Or they can be a source of untold misery. In areas where governance is weak or absent, armed groups may fill the vacuum and commandeer valuable resources for themselves. In such places, these groups may force villagers to mine minerals and then use the profits from their sale to fund insurgencies against legitimate governments or terrorize local communities. The United States has played a leading role in a number of international efforts to address the conflict minerals trade. Under one initiative, known as Dodd-Frank Section 1502, for the part of the law that created it, U.S. companies are required to account for the use of gold, tin, tungsten, and tantalum, and their ores in their products, and then investigate their supply chain to determine if these minerals were used to fuel the conflict in the Great Lakes region of Central Africa. This action was taken to break the link between armed groups and minerals and to create legitimate channels for these resources. Since this and other initiatives were begun, Rwanda and the Democratic Republic of the Congo have made progress in developing legitimate supply chains for their conflict minerals. Some armed groups continue to exploit the region's resources, however, posing a threat to regional stability and undermining international efforts to end the decades-long strife there. Toward that end, U.S. financial regulators have issued an order affirming that companies must report on whether their products contain conflict minerals from the DRC or neighboring nations. The deadline for compliance is June 2nd of this year. Developing a legitimate mining industry is critical for building an economic base for sustainable peace in the eastern DRC and Great Lakes region. Due diligence by U.S. companies plays an important role in combating the illicit exploitation of these minerals by promoting a responsible minerals trade worldwide.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.